Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned in the next hour for my interviews. Coming up in the first part of the show, I'll be talking with Andy Weiner, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships and the Acting Director of External Affairs at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA, in Washington, D.C. He will be sharing more information about the Joint Statement of Intent to Strengthen Regional Disaster Risk Reduction and Resilience, signed at the APEC CEO Summit in mid-November 2001, as well as sharing information about the Joint Polar Satellite System, among other topics. In the second part of the show, from 7:30 to 8 p.m. tonight, I'll be interviewing Travis Gilmore, Public Media Director for KAKM-TV, KSKA 91.9 FM, and the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN. He is also the manager of Town Square 49, an exciting and engaging online destination to share stories, ideas, and voice in words, photos, and videos. It's where Alaska happens, is their motto. Also on the phone call in that second interview, accompanying Travis will be Candace Winkler, CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. Remember that you can participate in the show by asking questions of my guests through Alaska Identity Project on Facebook, posting a question on the wall there, following the show on Twitter at Alaska ID Project, or also I've updated my blog, adriennechile.blogspot.com, where I also have a section on the Alaska Identity Project and the past guests who have been on the show. Andy Weiner serves as Director of Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships and the Acting Director of External Affairs at NOAA. In these roles, Andy focuses on establishing and sustaining private-public partnerships that support NOAA and the Department of Commerce priorities. He serves as one of the senior advisors to the NOAA Administrator on implementation of the agency's Strategic Action Plan. Prior to joining NOAA, Andy practiced law in Hawaii for 25 years, and he served as a managing partner of a law firm. In 2007-2008, Andy served as a state director of the Obama campaign in Hawaii, and in 2006, Andy managed Senator Daniel Akaka's successful reelection campaign. In 2005, Andy received the Hawaii State Bar Association's Pro Bono Award for his coordination of relief efforts related to Hurricane Katrina. Thanks for coming on the show, Andy. Are you there?
I'm here, Adrienne. How are you doing?
Great. I know it's late for you back there in D.C. Thanks for calling in tonight.
Well, it's good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Well, I just kind of want to start off by delving into the topic that actually brought us together when we met in Hawaii a couple weeks ago at the APEC CEO Summit, which I'll get into in just one second. But for those who don't know, but APEC stands for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation and is a regional economic forum that supports economic growth and prosperity. And Andy, you were there because your organization participated in signing a joint statement of intent to strengthen regional disaster risk reduction and resilience, which I don't want to say that too much. It's a mouthful. Can you give us some background on this statement and the importance of signing something like this?
Sure. This was an effort that actually started as a result of communications between Pacific Command, which is the military command in Hawaii, the University of Hawaii, and the Chamber of Commerce. And the United States Chamber of Commerce, and the issue that they're trying to deal with is that approximately 70% of the natural disasters that take place in the world occur in the Pacific Basin. And
yeah.
What ends up happening is that the military basically ends up serving as almost the first responders. And because of that high percentage of incidents, their resources are being taxed. And so what Pacific Command wanted to do was to see if it would be possible to bring together a private-public partnership of some kind that could focus on a few different things relating to disasters. And so starting with that, NOAA, FEMA, USAID, which is the foreign aid part of the United States government, the
mm-hmm.
Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and a number of other entities got together in August to talk about what were some of the things that could be done. People were, I think, excited by the idea that that partnership could be meaningful. And so the signing in at the APEC meeting was really a step forward in trying to get that partnership formalized so that we can actually start moving forward and doing some things.
Yeah. Now, I know NOAA obviously has dealt with disasters in the past, but these other organizations, had they had any experience with this type of involvement, or the Rockefeller Foundation, for example?
Well, what the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation do is that they end up funding projects primarily in other countries to get those countries ready for disasters. So, in other words, in a developing country, making sure that if you're going to be doing construction, that you're aware of where a tsunami inundation zone is. Or after a disaster occurs, they would be among the types of groups that would provide funding for cleanup projects or for getting aid or getting or assistance to areas that have been hit by a disaster. So all of the organizations that have been involved or are involved definitely have something to do with disaster response in one way or the other. And the nine organizations and entities that got together are really the beginning. The hope is to build a much larger network of entities that exist in the United States. And then we also are beginning to encourage other countries to try to develop things that are similar. So that in the end, what we'll have is what we call a network of networks, where we have people and entities that know each other before a disaster happens. That's really what the key thing is that when something happens, that we actually know who to call and to begin to work together. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do with this partnership.
And did that work? Did you find that talking and signing this intent statement at APEC actually involved other countries in the Asia-Pacific region that were there?
Absolutely. One of the signatories to the agreement is the U.S.-Japan Council, and they have been communicating with Japan. So there's interest, especially after the tsunami and the earthquake from earlier this year. There's interest from Thailand. There's interest from Australia. And so one of the things that will be happening as we go into 2012 is to begin doing some outreach. And the idea is not for us to tell the other countries how it is that they should stand up their groups, but to make them aware of how we're doing it. And hopefully that will encourage them to do something similar, so that we can then start to have those connections so we can look for things that we can actually start to work together on, because many of the problems in the Pacific are not just United States problems. They're problems that involve other countries as well. So, for example, the debris that's coming from potentially coming from Japan after the tsunami is something that is not only a Japanese problem, but it's an American problem, and it's a problem that we really need to figure out how to deal with cooperatively. So that's one of the things that we think that this type of group is going to be able to do, is to bring common focus and resources to deal with problems such as that.
Yeah, and that piece of public-private collaboration is really important, right? I mean, have you seen this kind of initiative in other areas? Did you model it after something else?
There have been other efforts that we've been involved with, particularly in the area of resilience and also in disaster response, where you see in a lot of instances where you have non-governmental organizations, private sector companies, the Chamber of Commerce and government entities they actually come together and work together to respond to a disaster. The problem with that, though, is that a lot of times people are getting to know each other and what their capabilities are after a disaster occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that the Chamber of Commerce has been really involved has emphasized is that the last thing that you want to be doing after a disaster is exchanging business cards for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So the model is more proactive than anything that I think has been in place as it relates to disaster response. But it's something that is modeled after the way that there have been efforts to deal with disasters after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Andy, when we talk about disasters, we're not just talking about natural disasters, are we? This includes other types, correct?
That's correct. And I think that one of the things that especially in the Pacific, that we're sensitive to is not only things like tsunamis and earthquakes and hurricanes, but we also have things like oil spills that we're dealing with, or what happened with the nuclear reactors in Japan. And then I think another one that we're looking at, quite closely, is climate change and the effects of climate change, especially on a lot of the Pacific nations that are experiencing sea level rise and are beginning to see actual impacts from that sort of thing. So part of what we hope to be able to do is to focus on some of those longer-term issues that we can see from climate change.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was also at the APEC summit talking about this issue. Did she emphasize any other important areas in this joint statement?
Well, she emphasized the importance of what we were doing. She actually mentioned the private-public partnership, the group that we were standing up, and made it clear that what we need to do from the U.S. government side is look for creative ways to be able to go ahead and look at these issues. And I think in the aftermath of what happened in Japan, we all recognized this was really a critical time where we needed to learn from what we did right and what we did wrong as it related to that effort. And so a lot of what Secretary Clinton was urging us to do was really think beyond just what currently exists, and let's try to figure out models that actually will work. And so, you know, with her backing together with the Chamber of Commerce and some of these other groups, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of momentum to really look at problems like this and take them on in advance. Like, what do we do? What do we do to prevent significant disasters? What do we do to make the areas in the Pacific safer to make sure that if a disaster does occur, that we're ready for it?
Yeah, exactly. So what are the next steps related to this? Is this group going to meet again? Is NOAA kind of taking the lead on it? What do you see in the next year to 5 years?
Yeah, I would say that we actually did have some very, very positive meetings when we were in Honolulu at APEC. And what we're working on now is we're trying to stand up the formal entity that's going to be this collaborative group. And we'll hopefully come up with a more catchy name than the Disaster Risk Reduction and Resilience Collaboration, which is a mouthful. So I think that's one of our things, just trying to figure out a better name for it. But what we should have by February is, we should have the final memorandum of understanding, which sets out where it is that we're going to be located physically, how it is that we're going to actually govern ourselves, how it is that we're going to do outreach to other entities that we'd like to see join this effort, and we think that there will be many that will be interested in it. So that's what we hope to do over the next 3 months. And then the plan is that next August we hope to reconvene with a fairly large conference with some of the leaders from the organizations that already are in place, and hopefully invite some of the leading foundations in the country to come and listen to what it is that we're going to do. And the hope would be to get funding and to get the type of assets that we need in order to do some of the work that we're looking at. And then we've got three projects right now that we're probably going to focus on. The first is a mapping exercise, which is really designed to make sure that in places where there has been a disaster, that you can go to one source and see exactly what type of disaster relief is being done.
Wow.
So if you're a private individual or a church or some group that wants to help afterwards, instead of trying to puzzle your way through it, you'll be able to go to a single source, click on the website and see exactly what efforts are in place and be able to plug in. So that's one. The second will be an educational component in which we hope to bring governmental and military leaders to the University of Hawaii. And the university has a terrific disaster preparation program that's part of the Department of Homeland Security's program. And what we're hoping to do is to expand that to include participants from foreign countries. And then the third thing we're looking at is a project that is related to trying to deal with some of the debris that was generated after the tsunami in American Samoa back in 2009 and sucked a bunch of things like clothing and cars and washing machines into a coral reef. And unfortunately, there's no governmental resources available to remove that sort of debris. So we're hoping to be able to bring some of the foundations and non-governmental organizations and the private sector together to adopt that as a project and actually begin the work of cleaning up that reef.
Yeah.
Those are the things that we should be doing over the next year, which if we do a lot of that stuff, that will be a successful year. That's a lot of work.
That's a lot of work. And on the first one, it's interesting, the mapping, because after Haiti happened, a friend of mine who's very involved with NGO community started this disaster accountability project to see how all this money goes into these disasters, and there's really not a lot of accountability a lot of times. What is actually happening on the ground? So anyway, maybe I'll send you that resource later, and that can get involved in this effort. Yeah.
Because now, we talk a lot about Haiti and learning from some of the mistakes there, so that would be helpful.
Yeah. And just the last piece here, Russia will be next year's host of APEC. Are they involved at all with this effort?
At this point, not directly. They will be one of the entities that gets invited to what we do in August when we present what it is that we're doing. I think that the goal would eventually be to include all of the APEC economies as part of this program. They're not part of the first wave, but
yeah.
I think that the hope is that by the time we go to Russia that we're ready to present where we've gone, and I would hope that Russia would consider joining us. That would be a valuable partner for us to have.
Yeah, definitely. Now, kind of transitioning into segueing into a topic that also is related with President Piñera's visit. And for the listeners out there, if you're just tuning in, I remind you this is the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez, and we've been talking to Andy Weiner, who is Director of Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships and the Acting Director of External Affairs at NOAA in Washington, D.C. So, Andy, President Piñera was he's the president of Chile. He was in APEC. It was in Hawaii. You invited him to a big event, which was the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. Can you tell me a little bit about that visit and what happened that day?
Well, it was, I think, it was a great opportunity. It was a real honor for NOAA. It was one of the first foreign leaders to visit a NOAA facility. And there are, even though they are geographically quite distant, Chile and Hawaii share a common bond as it relates to tsunamis.
Yes.
And many of the tsunamis that have been the worst ones that have hit Hawaii have actually been generated from earthquakes that have happened off of Chile. And so the warning system that is now in place to deal with tsunamis, Chile is part of that system. And it's something that we've actually tried to beef up over the last couple of years. Some of your listeners may recall back in February of 2010, there was a severe earthquake off the shore of Chile. It was an 8.8 earthquake and generated a tsunami for Chile and a tsunami warning across the Pacific.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened during that earthquake is that the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii was among the first to pick up the signals related to that earthquake and to the tsunami, and actually was the one that was phoning in some of the information that was used in Chile. So the Chilean president wanted to come and actually meet the people that were on duty that day and to thank them for their efforts that day and to discuss what we could do to cooperate with Chile to improve the tsunami warning system. And obviously Alaska has an interest as well in making sure that the tsunami system is well maintained. So, it's one of those things where people that have coastal areas that are prone to earthquakes are very, very much aware of tsunamis. And so we share that bond with Chile and got a chance to host him and to show him what we do and to also introduce him to the three individuals at NOAA that were on duty that day.
Wow. And what was his reaction? Had he ever visited this center before?
He had never been there before. We had never had anybody from the Chilean government. There had been people that had been in the science area for Chile that had visited. But he was very interested in seeing some of the mapping and some of the computer modeling that we had put together that showed exactly what happened on that day, how the tsunami waves were generated, what happened that day, and how it was that we were able to get the warnings in. It happened that one of the technicians that was on duty that night was a Cuban American who spoke fluent Spanish.
Oh, great!
And so it was fortuitous that when the information was coming in, he was able to get on the phone right away with his counterparts in Chile and to provide that information. And so the president of Chile was I think particularly interested to talk to him and to talk about his experiences on that day. So it was a very exciting day for us at NOAA. I think it helped to build the bonds and the connections between the two countries, and I think to make our tsunami system a better warning system.
Definitely. Now, Andy, I don't know if you know, but I was actually in that earthquake as well. I was living in Chile on the 16th floor apartment, and the building was shaking. It was a pretty scary experience.
Three minutes of shaking, from what I understand.
Yeah, I thought the building was going to fall over. And Haiti had just happened a month before,
yeah.
And so I was very, very scared. So, but the tsunami, and is it true that they said that the tsunami, there was an initial one down in Chile, but then there was some of an underwater landslide a couple hours later, and then another wave came in?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's right. That's exactly what happened.
Okay, because that's what killed
that,
people.
And that's actually, the second event was one of the things that we also detected and were able to report to the civil defense authorities in Chile to help get them ready.
Wow. Yeah, that was a scary time. And did you ever go down there afterwards?
I have not yet been.
No.
Since the time of the earthquake. It's something that I hope that I'm able to do at some point as we work to build better ties with them.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's a beautiful place. So, Andy, another area that we'd like to discuss here is this Joint Polar Satellite System, and I know it's something that has more of a direct impact on us here in Alaska. Can you explain what the JPSS is and why we should be concerned here in the great state of Alaska?
Yeah, this is a weather satellite system that should be of great interest to the people of Alaska in particular. I mean, it's something that's important to everybody in the United States, and it's a problem that we're going to be facing in the next few years that hopefully we're on the way to addressing, but we're not there yet. The short version of this is that the Joint Polar Satellite System is what is known as a polar satellite. It's an orbiting satellite, and we have two of them for NOAA. And the data that comes from the polar satellites as well as our two stationary satellites are what provide the data that allow forecasts to be made. And so one of the things that NOAA does is that there seems to be at least some misconception that you have people like the Weather Channel or other folks that are the ones that are generating the data that allows them to do forecasting, when in fact that information is actually coming from NOAA, and a lot of it is coming from that data is coming from our satellite system that's up there. But the problem that developed over the last year or so is that one of our polar satellites is going to be out of service, will likely be unable to continue orbiting after about 2015 or 2016.
Oh.
So we were in the process, what the JPSS project is the satellite that is designed to actually replace the one that's now starting to degrade and over the next 3 or 4 years will likely go down. And because of a number of things that happened in D.C., the funding request that we put in for last year was not granted, and we were left with the situation where we couldn't go forward with the project. And we are now getting funding as of the new budget cycle, and Senator Begich, among others, was largely one of the leaders for that. But the problem is going to be because we have that delay in the funding, we will have a time period in 2015 and 2016, which we believe will be about a year and a half, where we will not have that data.
Wow.
And for Alaska, that's going to be a real issue, because in Alaska, as I said, there's two kinds of satellites. There's stationary and there's the polar ones that move and are orbiting.
Mm-hmm.
And for Alaska, the problem is that the geostationary, the ones that are actually set in orbit, are not available for large parts of Alaska. And so the problem for that is that when you have a lack of data, it's going to make it difficult, especially in those remote areas where there are lots and lots of people in Alaska that are getting around in light aircraft, and those aircraft rely on data that's coming from polar satellites in order to know what weather conditions are like, and that information is going to be degraded. So there's going to be issues during that time period for people that have airplanes. It's going to impact the ability of the agency to provide data as it relates to marine weather. So it's going to cause problems for the shipping industry in Alaska, and especially as it relates to the shipment of oil and gas out of Alaska. So those are things that are really troubling. It's something that we really worked hard to educate people on. The Alaska delegation, you know, was definitely one of the vocal voices out there trying to make sure that this gap in data did not occur. And although we have the funding this year, as I said, I think down the line this will become, I think, more and more of a story as we get closer to 2015 and 2016. And that data is no longer there. We've become somewhat spoiled, I think, in terms of the data that's out there. And now we're going to have to experience really a 20, 30, 40-year step back in time because of the lack of data that we'll have when our satellite that's up now is going to be out of service.
So in 2015, knowing this now, there's no way to remedy that or do something additional.
There's no way to get a satellite ready in time to replace what's up there now. It takes several years to develop these satellites with the instrumentation that they need, and there is no foreign country that has the type of satellite that we would need in order to replace that data. So it's quite simply a bleak situation as it relates to that time period. And we're going to try to move as quickly as we can to get that replacement satellite up there. But it is likely that there will be some period of time where we will have impacts that I think are going to be felt all over the country because it's going to impact our ability to predict weather. But in Alaska, I think it's going to be more severely felt than any place else.
Wow. Is there another area of the country that really depends on this as well? I mean, I'm sure everywhere does, but another state?
The other places that really do rely on it more are the ones that have severe weather, and in particular hurricanes and tornadoes.
Mm.
And so it is going to impact our ability to do weather forecasts. So in the Gulf, there will be impacts that I think will be felt. And in the areas that are known as Tornado Alley, there will definitely be impacts because we won't be able to have the same kind of precise weather data that is used to you can't pinpoint tornadoes in advance that much, but what you can do is you can identify conditions 4 or 5 days in advance and let people know there's going to be a severe set of tornadoes in this general area, which is what we were able to do in both Tuscaloosa and in Joplin. And so we weren't able to eliminate loss of life in those areas, but officials in both of those places would tell you that it would have been far, far worse if we hadn't been able to get them warnings 4 and 5 days in advance.
Yeah, wow. Now, will this funding challenge be another challenge in the future with this? We're going to continue to have to educate our lawmakers about the importance of JPSS?
We are going to be challenged over the next probably 2 years. The way that satellite programs work is that you have periods where you have intense need for capital, especially in the build-up phase when you're putting the instruments together. So this year will be a challenge. We'll be looking for somewhere between $500 and $600 million for the JPSS program. It will come down slightly for the next year, and then it will start to flatten out significantly. But the next 2 years, we will need something close to $1 billion to make sure that we stay on schedule. And we hope with the number of severe weather events that have happened in the country, and I know that Alaska has had some recently, that those will remind people why it is that we need the best data possible so that we can actually get warnings out and get people to be aware of problems before they actually do occur. So the next 2 years will be critical. I think Alaska is fortunate to have in Senator Begich and Senator Murkowski two leaders that I think are very much aware of the situation. Mm-hmm. And they have really stepped up to fight for this, and I'm hoping that they will continue to do so in the future because, as I said, I think it's important for Alaska, but it's also really important for the country.
Yeah, let's hope so. And doing shows like this, we inform Alaskans of the importance of the Joint Polar Satellite Systems. And if someone out there, Andy, wants to know more information, not only on this issue, but on the joint statement or on your recent trip to APEC, where should they look online?
There's a couple places they could look. NOAA.gov, NOAA.gov. There's one place that they can look, and there's links to both the joint statement, and there's information if they pop in JPSS, or they look on the NOAA website under NESDIS, NESDIS, which is the National Environmental Systems and Data Information Services.
Okay.
That's the line office that does the work on the satellites. Or if somebody has a particular interest, my email, and I respond pretty regularly, is andrew.weiner, W-I-N-E-R, at NOAA, NOAA.gov. And if there's a particular question or an area of interest, then I'd be more than happy to get them pointed in the right direction.
Great, Andy. That's very brave, putting your email out there to the public.
Hey, that's my job.
Yeah, that's true. That is your job. You're a director of
my job.
Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships and Acting Director of External Affairs. So that's
right.
Important at the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Washington, D.C. I appreciate you coming on the show tonight, Andy.
Well, thank you, Adrienne. I enjoyed it, and I hope to get to see you someday in Juneau.
Yeah, exactly. And thanks for staying up late there on the East Coast.
Okay.
We'll be in
touch.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
This is Adrienne Lopez here on the Alaska Identity Project. We're talking with Andy Weiner at NOAA, Director of Strategic Initiatives and Partnerships and the Acting Director of External Affairs. I'll be back in the next half hour talking to Travis Gilmore from Alaska Public Radio Network and Candace Winkler from Alaska Community Foundation. Stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez here on KTO News Juneau 104.3. Thanks for staying tuned tonight. In the first half hour, we were talking with Andy Weiner from NOAA. He's the head or acting director of external affairs at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And in this half hour, we'll be speaking with Travis Gilmore, public media director for KAKM-TV, KSKA 91.9 FM, and the Alaska Public Radio Network. He is also the manager of Town Square 49, an exciting and engaging online destination to share stories, ideas, and voice in words, photos, and videos. Quote, it's where Alaska happens. Also on the phone accompanying Travis is Candace Winkler, CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. Are you guys there?
We're here.
Great.
Good evening.
Amazing communication. Anchorage and D.C. and everybody can all call in. So thanks for coming on the show tonight, you guys. Travis, I'd like to first start out with you just explaining a little bit more about your role there as media director for the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Well, sure. My main focus is largely on online engagement, a big in many places in the media, but especially in public media, we're looking more as a web first sort of thinking about what we do as a news organization, as storytellers. And so a big piece of that is using sort of broadcast is limited in that there's only so many hours in the day, but the web has a much more open and limitless potential as to what we can be delivering. So I'm working to bring the community into the work that we do at APTI.
Great. And is that the scope is all over Alaska?
Well, with the Town Square 49 project in partnership with the Community Foundation, yes, we are not limiting ourselves to just South Central Alaska, but really trying to reach out to Alaskans from, southeast all the way up to the North Slope.
Great, great. I know it's challenging. The state is very spread out, and we don't always have roads. Now, the Town Square 49 project is something that both of you are actually involved in. I know, Travis, you are the manager, but Candace is also involved from the Alaska Community Foundation. Can you both kind of explain your roles, how long you've been involved, and then we'll go on to what it actually is?
Sure. Well, thanks, Adrian, for having us on. And, this is a really exciting partnership and project, Town Square 49. And the Alaska Community Foundation, we're a statewide nonprofit with a goal to grow philanthropy and build community throughout the state of Alaska. And we were fortunate to receive a grant from the Knight Foundation out of Miami that is to address information needs of communities that you serve. And, so of course we looked towards APTI as a natural partner on this project. They have a wide reach and really have such great expertise in information, news, media. And the project is really exciting. I mean, the Community Foundation is engaged because we feel like for people to get involved in their communities, to be philanthropic, they need to know what's going on. They need to feel connected in their communities. They need to feel connected to the state of Alaska. And so Town Square 49 is a platform by which citizens can share their thoughts. Nonprofit organizations can talk about issues that they're working on and can lead discussions that will further engage citizens.
Wow. Do you feel it's been successful so far?
So far, I think it's been great. We just launched the site in mid-July.
Oh, okay.
So we're still pretty new at it, but we've been really excited about the quality of the information we've been getting. We've been getting some great photographs, videos, articles that people have written and, have been pretty excited. We've had kind of light fish stories to folks that are tackling racial issues or teen suicide. Travis?
Well, I think for us, one of the early wins has been nonprofit organizations really grasping on to the idea of having a hub where they can be you know, really sharing their good work and sharing the impact that they're having on their community. Mm-hmm. You know, as a lot of the traditional news organizations have been shifting and changing, there's been, you know, less reporters on the street, less ability to cover those kinds of stories. So giving them the ability and the platform to be able to tell those stories themselves and to reach more folks than they have in their own, you know, donor database or their own email list or that type of thing has been great for them. So that's really been the early win. Now we're kind of moving on to the phase of developing the concept and the culture of citizen journalism and how individuals can participate as well.
Great. So the contributors so far to Town Square 49 haven't just been these nonprofit organizations.
No. We've had a number of citizens, you know, folks that were already writing, folks that you know, are writing in other locations. So we see ourselves at this point as aggregating a lot of that content, but moving forward we're interested in you know, getting in there and developing that culture of citizen journalism and getting folks doing more of that work.
Yeah.
You know, Adrian, I think we also have found, you know, that this can be a nice platform for bloggers and people who may have, you know, already have some form of a following, but maybe that's a narrower base of people who may be following their work. And, you know, sharing some of their work on Town Square 49 is a great way to broaden their exposure and to maybe pull some of the, you know, readership on APTI's website, Alaska Public, to pull some of that readership to their individual blog sites as well.
Yeah. Now, are you engaging all age groups and demographics? I know that we talk about stories sometimes and you think of older Alaskans, but this seems to be more of a young initiative, no?
Well, I think one of the benefits that it has for the older Alaskan is the ability to you know, be able to get online and get your story out there and start that discussion without having to have those tech skills, without having to be able to start your own blog, without having to, you know, write code and know HTML and that type of thing, because we handle that for folks. But no, we've had contributors, you know, high school age contributors, and we have writers from our local Senior Voice paper here, so we've pretty much covered the gamut in terms of age.
Okay. And this is articles, video, pictures. Do you find that one dominates over another?
We've had a lot of good success with folks providing video content. It seems like, you know, there's one of the neat things that's been happening in the last few years is folks really grasping on to being able to make their own video content, and you know, sites like YouTube are great, but we provide a more focused platform for, you know, specifically Alaskan content. So video has been a big thing, which we've been excited about.
Right. You know, I think with the advent of smartphones and the, you know, the technology that's so accessible, it's such a great way to, you know, to get a quick message out.
Definitely, definitely. Now, was this something that just you thought of, Travis, or Candace, or did it come out of another project that you saw somewhere else in the United States?
Well, again, some of this, you know, the Knight Foundation, who is looking at information needs of communities, mm-hmm. You know, they really are tracking some of the changes in journalism that Travis talked about earlier. And, you know, the lack of local information that citizens are able to access. And so, you know, the Community Foundation, again, as, you know, as a group of people who are concerned, our tagline is connecting people who care with causes that matter. Mm. And, you know, so this kind of vacuum of local information really pointed to a project like this. And again, you know, I think Alaska Public is solely about, you know, information and building community. And, you know, so the project was sort of a natural, but Knight has funded for the past 4 years, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 of these projects around the United States. And so we're fortunate to be part of a cohort of people. You know, all the projects look a little bit different, but they're all sort of addressing this lack of local information and are really trying to empower average citizens to get engaged and share content, share their ideas, share their thoughts.
Yeah, that's exciting. Now, do you think after this grant cycle, or you, the people that receive this money, will there be some collaboration and sharing of best practices, these 10 other organizations that are out there?
Well, NITE does spend a lot of time with us, you know, gathering metrics, talking about what's working, what's not working. Because one thing they've really acknowledged, what the NITE Foundation has really acknowledged, is that a lot of these projects are experimental. Not all of them will be wildly successful. Some of them will live through the grant cycle and then, you know, fade away. Some of them will continue on and be taken up by their communities or future funding from other sources and grow and change and you know, meet the needs of their communities in the way that works best for them. But they're really experimental. So yeah, they are taking a lot of time. The NITE Foundation is working with us to take the time to document those things and convene groups to talk about that stuff.
That's great. Now, related to the material, Travis and Candace, do you filter it out? Is there a certain are certain themes you're encouraging people to post? What if something's a little bit too political? I mean, I think lately citizen journalism and it's the Occupy Wall Street movement and people talking about this kind of, you know, discrepancy or disparity in wealth and the wealth gap in our country. Are these some of the issues that are occurring? Give me some examples.
Well, we have tried not to align ourselves too much with the political blog type things that are happening, mostly because those things already have pretty solid followings for the most part, and we're more interested in elevating the voices that are less heard. You know, I don't think at the end of the day, and as we grow, we'll shy away from those things. If it's something that our community is interested in talking about, it's something that we need to take a look at. Our point is mostly about being fair and balanced and allowing folks to have a counterpoint.
And I would also say the other piece, you know, for folks that are logging in, they're using their Facebook profile, which tends to tends to be associated with a real person. You know, you have less people who have an abstract name, you know, Alaska Snow Bunny or whatever, you know. And so because of that, you know, we feel like we are getting less sort of
troll
biased, or just sort of information pushing, at least at this point in time. I mean, that's certainly something that we'll watch for, but mostly I think the goal is to, you know, to provide a platform and not do a lot of censorship. I mean, of course, you know, people need to be respectful of one another, and you know, I think there are probably some pieces that, you know, maybe they just weren't very high quality, but for the most part, you know, I think we're trying to let citizens create the news, citizens create the content, citizens create that dialogue.
Yeah. Now, Town Square 49, so you've got these contributors and people telling their story. What about the reaction from public? What kind of people are getting on daily or weekly or monthly to comment or to take part in this engagement?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that specific types of content seem to really to grasp the, you know, people's attention. There'll be certain things that I think, you know, are maybe I'll have one post that I think is a really well put together post. It has great photos. It's about an interesting topic, and it doesn't elicit much in terms of discussion. Then you'll have another piece that, you know, is equally as good, but maybe you didn't you know, you didn't feel one way or the other about it. But it just spurs something, and there's, you know, 20, 30 posts of people discussing it. There's, you know, 50 people who have shared it on their Facebook. There's X, Y, or Z number of people that have pushed it out. And I think so much of that, as I look into those analytics and try to figure out what that is, it's really about tapping into existing communities or connecting existing communities of people who are already talking about these things. So a big piece we had was about Filipino Heritage Month, and a local professor here at the university wrote a piece about Filipino heritage in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And that specific piece seemed to spark something, and it got shared all over the place, and it got a lot more views than another piece that just didn't spark in that same way,
yeah,
but was equally as quality written and produced in every way.
Interesting. Candace, do you have a favorite story or a popular one that's come up so far?
Well, you know, we have been airing. We also did a production recently. The Alaska Community Foundation does a series of what we call conversations about causes that matter. Mm-hmm. And we did one in that series in partnership with Alaska Public that has actually, I was listening to it on the radio mm-hmm. on the way over. We did it in Alaska Public Studios, and, you know, it's now being broadcast both for television and for radio. That was on teen suicide, and we used clips from the play Winter Bear, and then we also had a panel discussion and questions and answers, and we invited people to, you know, to share their thoughts and join the conversation on Town Square 49. And I really enjoyed, you know, reading those, of course, having been part of the studio audience and the panel presentation and hearing the live questions. It was nice to also see what, you know, what folks posted online.
Yeah, that's a big issue. Do people expect some kind of action after this dialogue taking place about this issue?
Well, you know, I think that we're looking at bringing people together who care about specific issues and topics and not really prescribing what the outcome will be. I mean, we know that if you get smart, passionate people together to talk about issues, there's a lot of good information sharing that can come from that. Certainly throughout that whole production, you know, we had lots of information about places where people could, you know, suicide hotlines, places you could call, places you could go, places you could get support or help. But also just looking at ways that we can sort of cross-pollinate information, and people who are working in the field know what one another are doing and are maybe able to make some connections.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I heard your interview that both of you had actually on was it APRN? That was on the website?
Yeah, that was the local KSKA program, okay. Hometown Alaska.
Okay, yeah. And there was a question the lady asked about Alaska identity, which I find interesting because that's the name of my show here, and how through these radio interviews we can discover our identity a little bit more as Alaskans. And I feel like there's something that you guys are offering, this platform to discuss Alaska identity through these stories. Do you feel that that's one of the goals and objectives of Town Square 49?
I think that that's, you know, that really does hit the nail on the head, and sort of speaks to why we haven't been prescriptive in, you know, we only want stories about X, Y, or Z, or we're focused on this, that, or the other. We're really interested to find out what Alaskans are passionate about, what Alaskans want to talk about, and that's one of the reasons why I think that, you know, we can think of this project as reaching out statewide. Is we don't view Town Square 49 as Anchorage or Juneau or Sitka or Nome or Fairbanks. We think of it as this, as a place for the concept of being Alaskan, which I think so many of us from all over the state, we identify first as Alaskans. Then we say, oh, I'm from Southeast, or I'm from South Central, or I'm from the interior or the North Slope. So, yeah, I think you're dead on with that.
Well, and I also think there's the opportunity, you know, for better understanding of, you know, different parts of the state. I mean, we have a huge geographic area, and we have a lot of diversity in some of the urban-rural divides. I mean, our hope is by having content and sharing from, you know, all different individuals throughout the state who, you know, may have very different lifestyles, that, you know, that sharing is sort of the first step towards understanding, acceptance, you know, all of the things that follow, all the things that build a community.
Yeah, that's great. And that's an important thing to do here. I'm glad you guys are leading the effort. Now, you're going to come to Juneau, I heard, Travis?
Yeah, we will actually be in Juneau a week from today, so Thursday the 8th, I suppose it is.
Okay.
And we're going to be meeting with some folks from the Community Foundation there to talk more about how they can get engaged with the project. But we're also inviting folks from Juneau and surrounding communities to come by and see us, or, you know, drop us a line, townsquare49@alaskapublic.org. We can get that information up on the K2 website for folks. But, yeah, to come by and ask us about the project, connect, and figure out how we can work together to share stories.
Yeah.
And Travis, where did we decide we were going to meet?
I think that we're gonna spend most of the afternoon at the Rookery. Does that sound like a good idea? Is that a good idea?
It's a great little place, yeah.
So
I'm getting nods from the studio.
Okay. I think we're going to spend most of the afternoon there and just kind of, you know, have office hours.
Okay.
So it's just an informal have a cup of coffee with us and talk about what's going on in Juneau and how we can, you know, work together on projects that we're all interested in.
We've got some fun little thumb drives with Town Square 49 on them and, you know, have some information for folks that are interested in becoming citizen journalists. And as Travis said, we'll buy you a cup of coffee. So come see us.
Wow. You guys are not doing that too much on air. You'll have a full house there at the Rookery.
Well, I hope so. I mean,
what time are we planning to be there?
I think we probably will be there 4 to 6.
Okay.
So, yeah, until we have to get out and hit our plane. But, you know, I think I'm more interested in talking to folks, listening about what's happening in Juneau, figuring out who the people we should be connecting with, more than, you know, giving some sort of formal presentation or something. I just, you know, want to get a sense of your community. I've been to Juneau a couple of times, but I love it every time I get to be there and talk about how we can work together.
Yeah, that's great. So that's the Rookery next Thursday here in Juneau. From 4 to 6 p.m., there'll be Travis, Ann, and Candace there. How do people identify you? You're going to have a big sign.
I'll wear my Town Square 49 T-shirt.
Okay.
It's bright purple. You can't miss it.
Okay. Purple's a good color for a guy.
Yeah, that's right.
And if they want to email you before, can you give out some more contact information? You guys are on Facebook.
Yep. We're Facebook, Twitter, townsquare49.org is the easiest way probably to get in touch with us. You can click right there, there's a little, contact us form that you can fill in, or you can email townsquare49@alaskapublic.org, but that's a mouthful.
And the Alaska Community Foundation is also on the web, right, Candace?
Yes, we are, and we're sort of connected through the Town Square 49 page, or you can find us directly at www.alaskacfcommunityfoundation.org.
Great, and I will post both of those on my Alaska Identity Project Facebook page so we can generate more traffic there to the Rookery next week.
Great.
Well, thank you, guys. Travis Gilmore, Alaska Public Radio Network, manager of Town Square 49, Candace Winkler, CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. I just want to congratulate and thank you for what you're doing with this project, and I really wish you the best of luck in getting more Alaskans involved in telling their stories. So
great. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, we'll see you next week in Juneau. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Identity Project here on KTO News in Juneau. Thanks to Martha Moore and Susan Dyer for their involvement and being studio engineers. Take care and see you next week.